16 to 1, a podcast about education, teaching, and learning.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
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 Here we are.
Here we are.
Another episode.
Another day.
Episode 33?
I think so.
Question mark?
I think it is.
Yep, that sounds right.
Checks out.
What's up?
You know, nothing too much. Just been buried under work. It's that time of year.
It is.
The long slog between, you know, it's the long
now
slog.
Now and forever.
Yeah. The long slog between now and then and forever from now.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's upsetting.
You have how many more weeks of school?
Mine feels the same, actually. If I had to describe what it feels like, it would be the slog between now and then.
The long slog between now and whenever the future may be.
It'll be our seventh book title.
Okay. Well.
Here we are.
I'm doing well.
I have 5 weeks, including this one.
Okay. Good.
How many weeks do you think are in May? 4?
That's not too right. Many.
Yeah.
There are too many weeks between now and my beach vacation.
Yeah, I have, we're only like halfway through of Mice and Men, and I am convinced we are going to get The Crucible done also this year, so.
I believe in you.
We are sprinting, folks.
I believe in you.
I, didn't plan very well.
It's okay.
Yes, Snow Days really kicked my butt.
It's the panini year, so you can just.
It is the year of the panini, the great panining. So what else?
I think that's about it, really. I'm feeling better. The weather is changing. It's like 80.
Oh, it was 80 today.
Yeah, it's like above 80 today. We're exercising.
My kids were pumped.
Everybody's excited.
We got a new gel pad seat for the Peloton.
Yeah, we don't have to hurt our butts
it
quite so badly.
It did help, I will say.
Yeah?
It didn't erase the pain,
mm-hmm.
but it did cut back a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Well, good.
And it matches like perfectly.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's color coordinated.
Yeah. Peloton's been good. We took Stella on a walk, the dog, and she pooped out at like 0.8 miles. So 0.88 miles, whatever it was.
Yeah, she.
Not quite a mile for her.
She really settled into her long winter's nap this year, the dog. And she's been having a little trouble being motivated to move.
Me too, Stella. Yeah. What else is going on?
I think that's it, really. We started a new show.
We did.
That blew my mind.
We started For All Mankind because a couple of my coworkers won't stop. And at this point, I feel like I just have to do it because
yeah.
I've already had to listen to them do it.
Well, we're one episode in and I'm already thoroughly invested.
Yeah, I wish we were watching it right now. I have been thinking about it today, actually.
Well, once we
get
record,
moving.
Yeah, when
here we go.
Get through this episode.
No, I'm just trying to think of anything
that's
fun. I got a new. Oh, I think I talked last episode about Hank Green.
Yes, you did.
I got his book.
It came.
I'm very excited.
It arrived. Yeah,
I did. What else? I think that's all of my. That's all of.
Oh,
my
I started actual. Reading Palaces for the People. I think
I do want to listen to that.
Yeah, I.
I regret that.
Well, I listened to it in audiobook form while I exercise, so that's. It's been good though, but yeah, I'm about a quarter of the way through, and it's interesting.
Yeah, I think that's everything.
It's the book
right?
I mentioned last time. Yeah, I think so.
This episode is different.
Is it?
Can I just tell you something?
Yeah.
One of your stickers is a Yeti dog.
Yes.
Oh my God. I think I would do anything to eat a Yeti dog right now.
Yeti dogs are really disgusting hot dogs covered in all kinds
what
of
is that sauce?
Sludge. It's Yeti sauce. I don't know.
Ugh,
some
that's
sort
how
of
they
like
get
tangy
you.
Aioli thing kind
if
of.
If you're in Big Sky, Montana listening to this right now and you can ship me a Yeti dog.
All of our fans in Big Sky, listen up.
I need one. That's all.
Yeah.
Oh, God, they're so good. That cheese.
Mm-hmm. Cheese and bacon.
I guess
the lifty.
Recording while hungry is not.
The lifty great. Is what we get when we get Yeti.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
I can like see it. That's how like we're, in this moment I am.
We're big fans of Yeti dogs.
Okay. Anyways, I'm hungry. So let's really.
Okay.
This
so we really are going to get on.
So I really want to watch TV and I really want to eat. That's my plan for the night.
So we're going to race through this episode really quickly.
Bye.
What are we talking about this week?
We are talking about, this is a weird transition, the history of sex education in the United States.
Sex ed. Okay.
And.
Hot topic.
This
perennially.
Will come as
perennially no, spicy topic.
This will come as no surprise, but religion is, you know, all the way in it. So.
All the way in it.
You know.
Yeah, they do.
You texted
seem-
me this morning and you were like, I was hoping to get some like connections for who was funding and who was, you know, advocating for
abstinence only education, and I think I only responded with the church.
Yeah.
Something like that. Or I think I just said religion, maybe.
I think here's the thing. So as you might imagine, modern sex ed, obviously very deeply rooted in various usually conservative Christian movements in this country, at least. But yeah, I was kind of just curious about how we got into the current predicament. And we found a lot of research about that. You actually found most of the research about it this week. So yeah, I mean, what I wanted to know kind of was there something before this thing that has been in our lifetimes, which is this fight over absence?
There has been, and it turns out it's the same thing.
It's the same thing, but different.
It had a different name.
The same, but different. Yep.
So would you like to take us back, or would you like me to take us through? How would you like to go through this history?
I will jump in. I'll jump in and take us back. Take us way, way back. You have us starting in sort of 1800s and 1900s.
Can I just say that there is a guest appearance by Graham Cracker?
There, yes, there is.
Was anyone expecting that?
Graham Crackers to make a guest appearance in our sex ed
episode.
I read
that and I was like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It was like the tidbit we read about Jack Black's mom the other day. I just kept reading and I was like, stop.
Yes.
Okay, we'll take us all the way back.
Yeah, so the earliest sex ed pamphlets in the U.S., we're kind of just limiting the scope of this a little bit. I mean, when I think of sex ed, the history going back to sex ed, I think of, like, I don't know if you've seen Spring Awakening, the musical, but it's basically just about, like, a horrible German boarding school experience where kids are not told anything about how sex works, and one girl tries to ask, and her mom tells her some made-up, like, stork story kind of thing. And so she's like, oh, okay. So then she goes out and have sex because she doesn't know what sex is. And then she gets pregnant. And the whole thing kind of disintegrates from there.
But,
like, here's the deal. It's like, when you don't tell people how sex works, they go out and do things that other people would judge as irresponsible. But they're really just doing that because they don't know anything about anything. And that is the sort of history of sex education, is people coming to that conclusion over and over and over again.
Great. So, you kept it really short this episode. I like that.
Yeah, that's very concise. It's all we need.
What if we just
did
a summary of Spring's Awakening and walked off stage? And
Mama
cut.
For me.
And
Mama
cut. Goodbye.
Gave me. Yeah. Okay. All right. That was my solo. Okay. Moving on.
Anyways, back to the 1800s.
Back to the 1800s. So, the earliest sex ed pamphlets.
The earliest.
That you found when you were researching in the U.S. addressed, as you could imagine, theology, of course. God has to be in there. And nutrition. Okay. Sure. Mm-hmm. They were also obsessed with the, quote, immense evils, end quote, of masturbation.
Yeah. Not a fan.
People really didn't like masturbation back in the day, including our friend Sylvester Graham. He, the very same, who used wheat flour to create the cracker that now bears his name.
That now bears his name. I'm going to be honest, I didn't know that's how they got the name.
Yeah, it's from a guy who really hated masturbation.
I'm devastated that I like them so much.
So he was, he used to travel up and down the East Coast in about the 1830s, warning audiences that gathered from far and wide
to see the Graham Cracker on stage.
The traveling Graham Cracker who talks about masturbation.
What if that was like you got a pamphlet and like a stack of crackers and that's what you sat there with? Your mouth would be so dry.
Oh, gosh. Well, so he would travel the East Coast warning people about self-pollution. Uh-huh. This was self-pollution, and he claimed somehow that it was responsible for everything from warts and constipation to insanity and death.
Yep. He just, that's a big one on the
So you can either have indigestion or you can die, and it's all from masturbating.
And it's all because of that.
I really want to know just how he came to that conclusion.
I didn't do any additional Googling on him because I'd read enough at that point.
How do you come to the conclusion that masturbation is responsible for warts and constipation and insanity? And death. That's a lot. That's a wide range of health problems associated with it. Anyway, so then we get some reformers in the 19th century.
Yep.
They start to associate bodily discipline with things like ideal manhood. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially a lesson in toxic masculinity.
Well, and also at that time, I didn't include this in the notes, but I didn't remember it from reading. They were basically, part of their spiel was like, if you masturbate, you won't have the energy to do anything. Like, they were putting it back on them to be like, you will not be a great contributor of your whatever because you'll be too tired and you won't be worth anything. And it's a definite, they played it hard on these people.
We've gone from scaring people by telling them they're going to die to telling people you're not going to be manly. You're not going to be a manly man if you masturbate, because that's for weenie men.
I don't think you can say weenie men in the
same
way.
Also, by the way, I'm sure none of these cases are in any way supposed to be about women masturbating. It's all about men masturbating at this point, right? The evils of masturbation.
I think they just assumed women still couldn't read. So.
You're probably right about that. Okay.
We're talking the 1800s. you can't vote, so you can't read. Moving along, sis.
Okay, so our friend and yours, the National Education Association. We talked about the formation of this entity back in an earlier episode. But anyway, they first discussed the subject as far back as 1892, when they passed a resolution that called for moral education in the schools. And by moral education, they mean we got to tell people not to have sex. Don't do the sex. Okay. So, do you want to take over?
Yeah, I was just going to start quoting Mean Girls because this is that movie, basically. But anyways, so we're going to jump ahead. Yeah. 1913, Chicago becomes the first major city to implement sex ed for high schools. But it doesn't last long because the Catholic Church swoops in and launches a campaign against them, even going as far as helping to remove the superintendent. I'm sorry, to have that superintendent of the schools resign as part of it. So as soon as there's a little bit of push towards that type of learning, the Catholic Church was like, don't think so.
Yeah, here's the thing.
We're going to cut that off right now.
I can get, and I always have gotten, where this can be a delicate and difficult issue to discuss with school-aged kids. I get it. I get that it's a challenge, that it would be very difficult to do it well, but the insistence that we can't talk about it at all because it's going to be temptation or that it's, I don't know. It's just proven over and over again to produce very dangerous and very destructive results when we shut down that kind of learning. So anyway, please. Yes.
So
continue.
This was basically the case until World War One.
Oh,
and
what happened in World War One?
STDs were spreading so seriously during World War One that the government had to become involved.
We're gonna have a shortage of soldiers in World War One because they can't keep it in their pants, basically.
So World War One is 1914 to 1919. So in 1918, Congress passed the Chamberlain-Kahn Act, which allocated money to educate soldiers about syphilis and gonorrhea. During this time, Americans began to view sex ed as a public health issue.
Yeah, well,
and so
go figure.
Before that, the American Hygiene Association, founded in 1914 as part of the Progressive Era Social Purity Movement, helped teach soldiers about sexual hygiene throughout the war. So they used a machine called the stereomotograph to show the soldiers microscopic slides of syphilis and gonorrhea, as well as symptoms of the diseases on the body of an actual soldier.
Okay, I mean, that's like a scared straight approach.
Right. So that's what they had to start doing to be like, hello, please be safe.
Please stop. Okay, so
there's wartime propaganda about this.
Yeah,
I guess I would say famous wartime propaganda about this.
The other thing I would say about this era is that prophylactics were not what they are now. So it was not, you can get, they pass out condoms like candy in college campuses now. So but that was not a thing at all. Like condoms, being ubiquitous, not a thing at this point in time. Birth control, I don't even know when birth control first came around, but basically all of the technology and medical advancements that we are used to and that have become incorporated into sex ed programs in the United States, none of that really existed in the Wild West of World War One. So it's a large push toward education, just informing people.
Yeah, just letting them know.
All you can do and hope for the best at this point in time. So, okay, interesting.
So then during the 1920s, schools began to integrate sex ed into their curriculums. And so like the military, they were trying to show, they were experimenting with using film as a way to teach sex education, essentially. For the government, they'd been using this one specific movie. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but it was a movie basically chronicling, the effects and what happened to this one soldier because of these things. So basically, that's also the route that school started running, was
it's
to show
the
videos.
The scared straight approach. Yeah.
So then we move on. In the 1930s, the U.S. Office of Education began to publish materials and train teachers for these types of learning. And in the 40s and 50s.
That's actually earlier than I kind of thought it would be. Yeah.
And then in the 40s and 50s, courses in human sexuality began to appear on college campuses.
Yeah.
And so In 1964, Mary Calderone, a physician who had been the medical director at Planned Parenthood, founded the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States. So this group was founded basically to challenge the power of this other group, the American Social Hygiene Association, which at the time dominated sex education curriculum development. So in 1968, the U.S. Office of Ed gave New York University a grant to develop graduate programs for training sex ed teachers.
Okay, so
so there was a push then to start training teachers on how to appropriately teach this. Uh-huh. But it was because of this woman, Mary Calderone, who had been the medical director at Planned Parenthood.
I see.
To form this group to create it.
Was this thing, this other thing, the American Social Hygiene Association, I take it they're just very
they were the opposite.
Anti, yeah. Like, we're not going to talk mm-hmm. about it because that's dirty and...
Mm-hmm.
They're in the Sylvester Graham side of things.
Yes, they are the Grahams, the Graham crackers.
Although, you know, you could call what Sylvester Graham did a kind of sex education, even though he was wildly misinformed.
Yeah, like, that's true.
He was educating in the wrong way, but at least he was talking about it.
It was definitely the wrong way. So then, some of the greatest resistance to sex ed arose during the sexual revolution of the late 1960s and early 70s. So sex ed became a political issue during this time.
And remains a political issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As religious conservatives built a movement based in part on their opposition to sex instruction in the public schools. So groups like the Christian Crusade and the John Birch Society attacked that Sexuality Information and Education Council of the U.S. And they were basically saying that that group that Mary Calderone had started or founded was just promoting basically promiscuity and moral depravity. So they were basically like, these are horrible choices. These are trashy people. We don't want to support this. And because it was a gout, you know what I mean?
I mean,
they
were
basically playing it against them.
This is the conflict that still exists in our country. There are people who say, we need to tell people how to have safe sex. And then there are people who say, telling people how to have same sex is essentially endorsing having sex. And we don't want to endorse having sex outside of these very strict parameters. You gotta be married, you gotta be straight, you gotta be blah, 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 blah. Yep. So even
preferably
just,
the only person you've ever been with.
That's the kind of thing that frustrates me about it, because it just... I mean, despite my own personal feelings about what role sex should play in relationships, it still would be the case for me that I would want people to do it safely and, you know, be healthy about it no matter when it happened. So it's just like the issue really always has come down to the power of the information about sex.
Yeah.
And who gets to wield that power? When do we get to wield that power?
What to do with it?
When is it appropriate for kids to learn about these things? You know, it is a complicated issue, but keeping people in the dark has never worked out very well for anyone. So fast forward, and now we kind of land in where we are now, which is into the waters of the debate about
chastity laws.
Yeah. Abstinence only or wait until marriage kinds of sex ed programming in U.S.
Promise
schools.
Rings.
Promise rings. Oh, God. Those were everywhere when I was in school. Okay. So in 1981, Congress passed the Adolescent Family Life Act. And this was, it was also known as a chastity law. It funded educational programs to promote self-discipline and other prudent approaches, quote unquote, to adolescent sex or chastity education. This was heavily funded, as you can imagine, by churches and religious conservative movements nationwide. Mm-hmm. The ACLU,
I bet the Coors family put a bunch of money
into that. The
Coors
family?
Oh,
gosh. I
bet they did.
We fell down a
Right up their alley.
I'm sure they did. We should go look that up. We fell down a really deep dark hole about the Coors, like as in the beer, the Coors family and the things that they fund and
how
the problems
horrible they are.
That how
they just
treat
came to
their
mind
workers
as
and
being like a family that would totally give to this.
If you could imagine, yes. Anyway, that's
sorry,
a whole rabbit hole that we could fall down. But
we'll do that one episode.
Yeah. So the ACLU is going to challenge this law, the Adolescent Family Life Act. They challenge it in court, calling it a Trojan horse that smuggled the doctrines of the Christian right, particularly in opposition to abortion.
They're not wrong.
To public school children at public expense in violation of the principle of separation of church and state.
Woo! Great work.
So, there's a whole bunch of back and forth.
A mere 12 years later.
A mere 12 years. So now we're in, what, 93? So this is, like, this really does
this
have an
is,
impact
this was
on
our this
education.
This was our learning, yeah.
12 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court held that federally funded programs must delete direct references to religion. Such programs could no longer, for example, suggest that students quote, take Christ on a date as a chaperone.
Ew. Also,
no.
What pamphlet? I would like to find that pamphlet.
Take Christ on a date as a chaperone.
This is like very Dare reminiscent to me.
It does have that feeling of Dare.
It's like, don't do any drugs because they'll all kill you. Well, and like, yeah, this is, yeah.
It is exactly. So like Dare is to drugs what the AFLA is to sex. Yeah. It's just like chastity education. It's just like abstaining is the only way you won't die.
Yep. We should get chlamydia
and die.
Don't have sex. You'll get pregnant and die. You'll
get chlamydia and die. Sorry.
There's a 30% chance it's already raining.
So
we should just cut into Mean Girls right now.
We should just start playing Mean Girls instead of
I'm a cool mom. Okay, I'm really done now.
Okay, so the idea of taking Christ on a date as a chaperone is both horrifying and illegal. As it turns out, this is according to the Supreme Court. According to the Supreme Court,
he's busy.
Well, okay, here's the thing: is it just like even a right thing? Like a Christian in their right mind would be kind of freaked out by the concept of Christ being your chaperone on a date. That's just not
again
the role
this,
that God
no,
is supposed
okay,
to play.
This
in your
line
life.
Of propaganda is exactly how those things work. Like there's wartime propaganda from World War II of a very normal white dude driving his car to work, and in it beside him is like a ghost Hitler, and it's basically promoting car shares, and it's like, if you ride alone, you ride with Hitler. This is that same
Yikes.
Branding. Like that is a propaganda device is like so effective for
one
people.
Of your favorite units to teach about is propaganda, right? So that's
it
why
is
you're,
but also like that line, take Christ on a date as a chaperone, is exactly like, if you drive alone, you drive with Hitler. You know what I mean? Like, it's uh-huh. placing all the blame on you, and the pressure is on you to make the right choice. So, like, it's just,
well,
it's so
shame,
effective.
It's very shame-based.
It is, but it's super yeah. effective for people that are already, you know what I mean?
Oh, shame is a great motivator. You
it's,
know?
Like, the best, I would say, at times. Anyways,
so,
sorry.
No, it's okay. So basically, we can't say that kind of stuff in federally funded programming.
Thank God. Also, amen.
So by that time, however, some of the biggest federal grant recipients, including Sex Respect, I would have
yeah.
never heard of, and TeenAid.
Yeah. I'm sure there's TeenAid.
They had already had success in getting schools
oh, yeah.
to adopt their programs. In 1996, Congress attached a provision to welfare legislation that established a federal program to exclusively fund abstinence-only programs. Since the inception of the abstinence-only movement, more than $1.5 billion have been spent on programs whose only purpose is to teach the social, psychological, and health benefits that might be gained by abstaining from sexual activity.
Yeah.
Okay, just as a note, everyone, abstinence-only sex education programs do not work. Just so we can all be on the same page about that.
If you're unsure why we're doing this episode.
If you're unsure why we're doing this episode, it's because they don't work. They don't do even what they're explicit purpose is, and that's to stop kids from having sex. Like, they don't do that. They do the opposite, probably.
Right.
So anyway,
so they came up with like a big list of goals, basically.
Yeah, I really want to hear.
Defined by the government, and so this was part of the like the program had to include these things, right, in order to receive the funds to do it. There are a lot of them.
Okay. By the way, the only reason so people wanted to fund sex ed. Congress wanted to fund sex ed.
Within their limits of what
well,
they believed it to be.
That's the thing. There's this huge... Congress wanted to fund sex ed because everyone's like, we have to tell kids about sex somehow. But there's obviously vast disagreement on how to accomplish that. The only way we could get any funding at all for sex education is to agree to do abstinence-only sexual
right.
education programming. So anyway, okay, continue.
So,
goals of abstinence-only programs.
These were all of the goals.
Mm-hmm.
Its exclusive purpose was teaching the social, psychological, and health gains to be realized by abstaining from sexual activity.
Mm-hmm.
It teaches abstinence from sexual activity outside marriage as the expected standard for all school-age children. It teaches that abstinence from sexual activity is the only certain way to avoid out-of-wedlock pregnancy, STDs, STIs, and other associated health problems. It teaches that a mutually...
So it doesn't acknowledge that gay people exist. Let's go, first of all.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Those aren't real.
No, okay.
Not in 19... Okay. What year is this? No
1996.
Chance. No. It teaches that a mutually faithful monogamous marriage is the expected standard. It teaches that sexual activity outside the context of marriage is likely to have harmful psychological and physical effects. It teaches that bearing children out of wedlock is likely to have harmful consequences for the child's parents, society.
I mean,
me being adopted is my favorite part of this. What else? Okay, that's the important one. The out of wedlock. Okay, next. It teaches young people how to reject sexual advances and how alcohol and drugs use increases vulnerability to sexual advances.
I mean, okay, that part is true.
It is true, but you just know how they taught it. It was, yeah. It teaches the importance of attaining self-sufficiency before engaging in sexual activity.
I'm still not self-sufficient.
Have you set up your 401k?
You've set up your 401k? Okay, congratulations. You can have sex.
Do you work 40 hours a week and have a master's degree? Great. Okay. This is so bad. Okay, so funding guidelines stipulated.
Do you have any special certifications in your area of expertise?
You have to have a doctorate.
Well, you can do sex plus then. Advanced sex. All right. Sorry. We're going to have to put an explicit rating on this episode, by the way.
Okay. So the funding guidelines stipulated that absence-only education grant funds cannot be used to provide instruction in the use of birth control or to promote the use of such methods.
Condoms, in other words.
Or just pills.
They can't talk about
Plan
condoms.
B or anything.
Any of that. But especially, a big part of this fight, I do remember, was over condoms. This is like right around the time where we're in middle school, and I absolutely remember turning on the TV and watching Congress argue about this crap. It was just like, ugh. Well, should we teach people about condoms or not? The answer is yes, we should teach people about condoms because that's how you have safe sex, but Congress decided no.
Right.
So.
Are you ready for our old friend to visit?
W.
In the last year of his presidency, W. requested $242 million
George W. Bush.
For absence-only funding in his proposed 2008 budget.
Mm-hmm.
The Congress signed off on $176.83.
Wait, what?
That's what it said.
Wait, what?
This is from Planned Parenthood also, all of this information. And I don't think that they
that
would...
That has to be million, right?
I don't think so.
Hold on.
I'm not kidding you. That's what it said on the Planned Parenthood PDF that I read and that I posted in the link.
I don't understand.
I think that they only gave him that much in that year.
You used $176 for your absence only. Wait, I'm so confused because they funded this other
thing. Click on the Planned Parenthood link at the bottom.
Oh boy.
And search for that.
This has got to be a typo. I think it's supposed to be million.
I would prefer it be $176.
It leaves off the million.
$0.83.
George W. Bush requested $242 million. They signed off on $176.83. And I think that they just didn't repeat the million.
Dang. I wanted it to be dollars.
But yikes.
Dollars.
Pennies. $176.
Well, what is that?
For the whole United States.
One speaker in Montana. I'm still thinking about a Yeti dog. Okay, anyways.
You really are. Okay.
Okay. So the total amount of federal and state tax dollars that was spent on absence-only programs during the entire Bush administration exceeded $1.75
billion.
Billion.
Okay, so I'm going to guess that
and
was
did it work?
$176 million.
What if at that point they're like, well, George, it's already been 100. It's too much now. Anyways.
Okay.
So between 2004 and 2008, five authoritative reports, including Kirby's, and I'm going to talk about Kirby, have shown that absence programs do not help young people to delay the onset of sexual intercourse. They do not help you prevent risk-taking behaviors, and it almost always includes misinformation. Great.
Go figure.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's Kirby. Okay.
Yeah. So sorry. This is Kirby's 17 Characteristics of Effective Pregnancy and HIV AIDS Prevention Programs.
Mm-hmm. So Kirby's summary basically says that in the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy published Emerging Answers, and that was Douglas Kirby's summary. So this is like his report. So he conducted 115 studies during the previous 6 years to measure the impact of sexuality education programs. And this was published in 2007. So basically from 2001 to that point, okay. he was running these studies. Of the 56 curriculum-based programs that were evaluated, 48 were comprehensive sexuality education curriculums. The other 8 were abstinence only at that point. So he looked at 56, 8 were abstinence only, the other 48 were comprehensive.
Okay.
So the reason that there were so few was that the very few abstinence-only programs had been rigorously evaluated, and the study found that all the rigorously evaluated abstinence-only programs were ineffective. So no program helped raise the age of first intercourse, no program helped teens postpone having sex, no program helped sexually active teens become sexually abstinent, no program helped reduce the number of teen sex partners, and none of the programs helped improve the use of condoms or other contraceptives among those that were were sexually active. So despite widespread public support, particularly from parents, only 20 states mandate sex ed and HIV education. Only 19 states mandate the provision of information about birth control. Only 9 states mandate inclusive instruction about sex orientation. And only 13 states mandate that instruction in sex ed and HIV education by a medically accurate.
Be medically accurate. Wow.
So that's what he was able to find from
all of this. I'm sorry. So 13 out of our 50 states mandate that instruction in sex education and HIV education.
That last bit came from a report in 2015, but it was based off of Kirby's findings.
But the only 13 mandate that it be medically accurate.
Yes.
So I guess I just don't understand. Like, that's the thing that really bothers me. It's just like, okay, what we should do is give people medically accurate information to help them make better decisions, because that's how humans make decisions.
Right.
And, well, here's the thing. Kids are going to have sex anyway. That it's just, that is the thing that is going to happen. And that's what this program, like the inefficacy of these programs, it just underscores that fact. It's like, okay, none of these programs help anybody who, you know, was thinking of having sex. It did not stop any of them. It did not make any of the sex safer.
So all of that money was just wasted.
Yeah.
On religious, you know, stuff, basically.
It's just a little disturbing to me that nobody bothered to mandate that what you would think would be programming about medical issues, it didn't have to be medically accurate. That's a little weird to me.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the most shocking things I read. Like, all the things that Kirby found, I, like, wasn't that surprised by, right? Because, I mean, we all know how the story goes. But that last bit from the 2015 report about what the states actually required and mandated.
When you think about the state of education, literally, like, mandating specific things to be taught by age, and, like, they can't throw in somewhere, you know, in a Common Core standard, like, some health-related, I don't know. Anyways.
So that's where we are today.
Well, it sounds like he
basically.
I mean, Common Core, that was NCLB and all this stuff. It would have been an interesting opportunity. There's no way it ever would have stood up to the scrutiny of Congress putting something like that in Common Core state standards or NCLB or
Right, but I just mean when there's data that's like, it did absolutely none of the things that we spent over $1 billion doing. I'm sorry, that's hard to wrap my brain around.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's still plenty of programs out there that that operate this way. There's still plenty of schools that offer abstinence only sex education.
Oh, still, yeah.
And it just, to me, it's just like an enormous waste of money, among other things. But also, it's not safe and it's not healthy. And we're not
making our kids any better.
The other
by
thing
doing
is that there are safer and healthier alternatives, and they've been mischaracterized as demonic by people who tie their ideas of morality very closely to sexual activity.
Yeah.
And I think it's perfectly reasonable to be concerned, even as a conservative Christian. I think you can have reasonable concerns about sex education without saying, well, therefore we shouldn't do it.
Right.
It should only be abstinence education. I just think that
there's an in-between.
You can both inform people about how sex works and also have conversations that suggest that, hey, maybe you shouldn't do this until you're older or you're ready or you're informed or whatever. I don't think that those things have to be in competition, but unfortunately, in our highly polarized political landscape, they always have been.
Yeah, and I guess, like, the one perspective I would like to bring to this is that as a teacher, right, I've been very fortunate in my career to ever have students feel this comfortable with me, but I have had students come to me after losing their virginity feeling worthless because they thought that their value was somehow, you know, like that was a reflection of them, that they lost their virginity and that.
Because they've been told that their entire lives.
Right. And so, like, I've also had female students come to me as a young female teacher, you know, and be like, where do I go to, you know what I mean? Like, so just because they're not talking to you because you're spewing whatever your beliefs are at home doesn't mean they're not trying to get help somewhere.
Right.
So, like, I guess my point is just that, like, even if you would prefer your child, which, like, I mean, who doesn't want their kid to make smart choices and healthy choices for themselves? But, like, you could at least help them to make the smartest choice for themselves by admitting that teenagers are likely to whatever. and like just hoping that they make good choices for themselves.
Yeah, I think
because like they're going to make these choices regardless, right? One way or the other.
You don't want to make it.
Then they come to me
kid.
Or to other yeah. teachers or whatever, and not that we can't bear this stuff because that's part of what we do, but as someone who's been on this side of it, right, as a teacher who's had to talk young ladies down almost always about that kind of correlation of their worth to their, you know what I mean? Like, it's very hard as a teacher to be like, well, someone just help this kid. Like, someone just should just talk to her. Like,
yeah. I guess it was the abstinence only programs, in addition to the like sort of physical health effects of it, abstinence only programs, like you're talking about, can create psychological health issues.
Oh yes,
which is exactly what you're talking about.
Which and is exactly
this is not
yeah.
even just formal, like formalized programs of sex ed, but like you're talking about conversations that parents have at home with their kids can really shape ideas of self-worth,
right.
ideas of worth as it pertains to relationships. Like, how
right.
do I, where do I derive my self-worth? And if I'm made to feel ashamed for X, Y, and Z
yes.
as a part of conversations around sex education, that can really negatively
right.
impact
and,
your relationship with your kids.
And that's been one of the hardest thing to like have to talk with students about, because how can their teacher convince them that they're not worthless when what they've been taught is that as soon as it happens, they are, you know what I mean? Like, and I can only do, I mean, I do my best obviously. And I try to make them know that that's not the whole sum of them, you know, that kind of thing. But as a teacher, it has been very hard. Like, those are some of the hardest conversations I've had to have, especially with young women, because it is so, you know,
yeah,
it's put on the girls. And I say girls cause they are young ladies when they're taught this,
mm-hmm.
literally, especially
yeah.
as females, that you should be pure and you like
oh,
whatever.
Yeah. We've talked about this issue in our back in episode 2 in our dress code issue. Like,
right.
Dress codes, they too underscore these points that, like, you know, women, you can't be a temptation to a boy, and like a girl, you can't be a temptation to a boy in a classroom. Therefore, you know,
yeah,
wear
they can't
clothing
right.
that covers
so
up all
you
of your parts.
Do what you should to take. Yeah. Anyways. So I guess that's my thing. As a teacher, I can say I've been on this side enough now. I've talked enough young ladies down, and like what you're talking about, like that mental health part is a very hard thing to overcome for them, because they now feel that they have no worth because of this one thing, literally.
Yeah.
So anyways,
we're in a very conservative and Christian part of the country here. So there's like a lot of this
yeah.
back
but
and forth that
I just,
we talked about
the,
is active here a lot.
And I have to tell myself, like in my head, I'm like, this is so stupid and you're going to learn that when you get older. But I also can't imagine being 16 or 17 and feeling that way about myself. Like, it would truly be helpless, you know?
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yep.
We can skip this part.
Well, no. I was just going to say it especially makes difficult conversations if somebody's been raped or assaulted. It
yes.
makes those kinds of
yep.
conversations, these
yep.
like very regressive attitudes
it's their
about
fault.
Sex education make those kinds of conversations
I've had those
very,
as well.
Very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It makes law enforcement's job difficult. It just makes it really difficult for
what makes them not talk?
To attach shame to
mm-hmm.
to sex rather than just sort of present information that is useful. Yeah, it's dangerous in that way too. So anyway, all right. Well,
yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So the next part of this very important podcast is a plug for Planned Parenthood. Cue the music, Chelsea.
I don't have music.
What if I had music? So almost all the information that we included up to this point came from Planned Parenthood, because mostly they're the largest, most trusted provider of sex education in the United States. In 2015, Planned Parenthood affiliate education departments provided sex ed to over 750,000 participants, and the majority, 75% of those, were teenagers and young adults. We're talking people aged 12 to 24. 54% of the participants received sex ed in a school setting. Another 19 received it in a non-religious community-based organization. And sex education was also delivered in a diverse family of settings, such as social service agencies, religious institutions, and juvenile detention centers. So, like, truly Planned Parenthood is getting out into all the places that the community is, and they are getting to people, which I think is so important for this type of learning. Planned Parenthood has trained over 20,000 professionals, including counselors, teachers, and medical professionals, on how to effectively deliver sexual health messages to young people as well as adults. The other professionals that are trained by Planned Parenthood sex eds include college and university faculty and staff, religious leaders, public health workers, and other human service providers. They also train community health workers, promoters, and teen peer educators. They've reached over 112,000 young people in 2015, and promoters reached another 127,000 people, and that was just in 2015 alone. So we're talking millions of people who have been impacted by the work that Planned Parenthood does. So this is my shameless plug to donate to them,
yeah,
to support them in your communities, to make sure that the people who need Planned Parenthood are safe to go there, whatever that looks like where you are, mm-hmm, and to make sure that we are not defunding it, because it is a great risk to our communities to lose Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, Planned Parenthood is obviously a very hot button political issue because some Planned Parenthood clinics will perform abortions. So especially in this area, it's always, you know, people are always protesting in front of Planned Parenthood and stuff. But mm-hmm, I think that, to me, in line with my attitude about people are going to do it anyway, like,
if make it healthy and
safe. Something is going to happen and it poses a public health risk.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, like, you know, people being upset about Planned Parenthood, you know, performing abortions. Okay. I get that you're upset about that. You're entitled to be upset about that. I personally have, like, complicated feelings about that. I don't have it settled either way. But I do think that if it is the case that people are going to be physically unsafe, regardless of people's political feelings about it, that we should make safe and healthy options available. Mm-hmm. It's the same issue with sex education. Your abstinence-only programming does not do what it sets out to do. Mm-hmm. So in that case, we should provide people with safe and healthy information and options, right, about sex education. So it's the same thing. Planned Parenthood is just, like, highly associated with abortion just because of how divisive that wedge issue is in this country. But like you're saying here, they perform all kinds of very useful services to communities and to schools and to all kinds of people. So it's not,
I mean, yeah, and you're right. Like, getting rid of Planned Parenthood only puts young women and women at risk, and it only makes things much more dangerous. And so yeah, I could go on forever, yeah, about the work that they do, but it is so much more than just abortions.
It's a very small slice of what they do, abortion-related services, very small slice, sure, of what Planned Parenthood does. And again, it's like the same thing. It's like, we've been having this conversation about some of the COVID vaccines, because I think at least one of them had, you know, research derived from something.
Johnson & Johnson.
Yeah, the J&J vaccine.
Stem cells, I think.
Yeah,
it was.
Like,
or embryonic cells.
Embryonic,
like,
cells,
from,
right. So, like, people,
I think,
were,
it was from two, yeah, aborted.
People around this this area were freaking out about J&J because it had, you know, blah blah blah. I actually read it or saw an article. I didn't read the whole thing, but somebody, one of my acquaintances, posted it, and it was about how she's actually a fairly conservative, I think she's Catholic, but she was advocating for getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine if that's what was available to you, despite the fact that it was derived in part from embryonic cells. And the reason for that is because, you know, we don't want to create more evil because part of this thing was distantly derived from evil, yeah, or whatever it was. And I think that that's generally a healthy, yeah, attitude. I would hope it would be a healthy attitude that even conservatives, Christians in this country could take, in that, like, yes, we've established that some of these things can have problematic origins or difficult conversations can develop around these things, but we are actually now in this present moment doing good by providing these services to people.
Yeah.
Because of X, Y, and Z, because, right, it would be unsafe otherwise, because they would be, you know, in danger otherwise. Yeah. Their lives would be in danger otherwise, yeah, without,
I mean,
the opportunities for these
countless
services.
Women have died trying to force themselves to have an abortion.
Yeah.
I mean, so, like, we're talking about literally life and death here.
And it's getting more and more difficult to access these services.
Yeah. Especially with the state of our healthcare system. So Planned Parenthood is, as always, one of the most important things we can be supporting in our communities, because, I mean, they're affecting literally millions of people every year, and there are not a lot of places that can say that. So,
yep,
important work that they do.
All right. Want to move on to fill in the blank?
Yeah.
Okay. You want to read last episode's question?
Last episode's question was this. The Library of Alexandria became an intellectual jewel of the ancient world, including at its peak 500,000 papyrus scrolls containing works of literature and texts on history, law, mathematics, and science. This library and the research opportunities attracted scholars from around the Mediterranean, some of which included Euclid and Archimedes, who even lived on site. Unfortunately, and not surprisingly, in 48 BC, a famous Roman general and statesman may have set fire to the harbor during a battle against Egyptian ruler Ptolemy the 13th.
He definitely did.
Ruining this library. Who was that famous Roman? Brutus's best friend, Julius Caesar.
Julius.
Yeah, I mean, like I said in the last episode, he's always an easy scapegoat, but I do believe it to be true also, because he's pretty reckless.
Mm-hmm. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, that we ourselves are underlings.
Oh, dear.
My kids like that line. It's where John... Oh, my gosh, more John Green. Look.
Yeah, John Green everywhere.
Okay, I'm sorry. This podcast is only sponsored by John Green.
And Shakespeare.
Yes, those are the same thing.
Your turn.
I really don't think they are, but that's okay.
Ash John Green. Have you seen them in the same room?
No, I haven't. I guess you have a point there.
It's like Batman.
Okay, this episode's question. This period drama, and I like this show. I only watched a couple seasons of it, though.
I've never heard of this.
It's pretty good. This period drama, starring Michael Sheen and Lizzie Kaplan, follows two pioneering researchers of human sexuality at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Series begins October 1956 and ends in August 1969, presents a fictionalized account of the uphill battle to inform Americans about how sex actually works. Hmm. What is the name of that TV show?
Never heard of it.
Okay. What'd you learn this week?
Oh, this is good. Okay. I actually really learned.
You really learned?
But I forgot. And so you had to remind me by going back through.
I had to tell you what you learned.
What was it? You went back through your Google search?
My search history. I always go back through my search history to find a fun tidbit that I learned. Okay. Yeah.
So Chelsea sent me an article, I think it was 2 weeks ago, about the woman behind Van Gogh's success. And
his notoriety now, I guess I would say.
Right. Because mm-hmm. He was known at the time when he was living, but he died so young that obviously he later became what he is today.
He was not famous.
So Van Gogh's brother, it was his wife. Mm-hmm. So Van Gogh's sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. Van Gogh died, and then very shortly after, his brother died, leaving her in charge of all of his paintings, essentially, because there was no other family.
His brother was an art dealer, and his brother had just like apartments full of Van Gogh's tortured works.
And so when the brother died, that left his wife, this woman, in charge of figuring out what to do with them.
I think her name was Jo, wasn't it?
Something. And I think that's right. Mm-hmm. So I'll share the link in here. It's an incredible piece. It's so interesting to read about the work of a woman to literally create Van Gogh's legacy. Like, I had no clue that that's how it was done. And basically all of the art dealers at the time, when she was trying to get Van Gogh's stuff out there, was like not, I mean, he was not the style at all, essentially. And so
the Impressionists were new and hip and young.
Yeah,
and
so he
realism was like the snooty patootie way of looking at
She was
at art.
Pushing him like so hard. Mm-hmm. And what she learned that you do is when you're trying to sell Van Gogh's, or when you're trying to like make, you know what I mean? Like, for a while she was selling them, obviously, and she was keeping some of her favorites. But she realized that in order to sell them, she had to bring some famous ones along with her that they had to agree to not sell. So you might see the, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, you might see, which wasn't popular at the time at all, and was one of the least liked by her.
Yeah,
and
his brother didn't like that one either.
No one liked it.
They were like, you're best when you're doing things that are closer to reality.
Yeah, can you just focus on some trees real quick? Yeah.
One of the letters between Van Gogh and his brother, well, you're at your best when you're doing better, more real things.
And like not as self-portraits, like all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So she was basically toting around some of the most well-liked and famous pieces, putting them up beside the pieces she was trying to sell to try to raise the price of them so that she could survive off of this deal. And so it was like, again, I'll share the link, but so cool. Like, she shared one of her favorites and then bought it back almost immediately, like had immediate regret for one she let go of, got it back. And so that was really cool, which also led me to my other really quick one, which was... I don't know why I got so into this art reading that day.
Yeah,
but
you went
down
a rabbit hole.
Into another article about Rembrandt.
Uh-huh.
And the guy who takes care of the Rembrandts. And this dude, Jan 6, I don't remember what number 6 he is. He's like the 8th or something like that. They've all been Jan 6s, but they are in charge of Rembrandts. And they live in a home that's full of Rembrandts. And so this Jan 6, the one that this article is about, which I'll also link at the bottom, is one of the only people to believe to have ever found two Rembrandts.
Two previously unknown Rembrandts.
So there's a bit of art drama involved. It's very hot. It's like, it's pretty cool. It was like a little Da Vinci Code at times as I was reading it, because I was like, oh, this is not going to end well for everyone. So I learned some very weird stuff about Rembrandt and Van Gogh. It was really fun reading. I love that type of stuff. I didn't know I did, but it was just... like I said, I'll include both links. Mm-hmm. Great reads, both of them. Cool. It was fun. And we got tickets to see the Van Gogh Immersive Experience.
Yeah.
In December, because that's how far ahead you have to actually buy tickets. So I guess Van Gogh's just been on the brain, but it's just kind of exciting to look forward to that. Mm-hmm. And to also, and there's also some like doubt about how Van Gogh died. And so that was something that she addressed. Like this article talks about. Yeah.
There's disagreement about whether or not he killed himself.
Right. And so, you know, and it's also,
I don't really know the history of that debate, but
they're not sure if it was intentional or not is the whole point. Interesting. But also like, obviously mental health plays such an important role in Van Gogh's story. So just a really cool piece. And like, had it not been literally for his sister-in-law who just kept his stuff because her husband wouldn't get rid of his paintings, like we wouldn't have any Van Gogh. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, he's one of the most beloved painters ever, and he lived his life in relative obscurity.
Yeah, and I mean, I am not someone who knows art in that way, but I love Van Gogh just to look at it. Don't ask me anything about the style or the technique. It's just pretty to me.
It's just pretty.
But I love his stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it was just, it was really interesting to read about. It was a piece, both of those pieces about Rembrandt as well, just kind of sucked me up into them. Cool. And I just felt like a big sponge, and it was nice.
We'll be sure to link to those in the show notes.
What about you?
Oh, I learned something much less fun.
I'm sorry.
Somebody handed me, this is a work thing. I got handed a really messed up computer. And so I was like, okay, nothing is working on this machine. I'm just going to reinstall the operating system and start from scratch. And what I learned, if you run Windows, there's an option to create what's called recovery media, where you can create basically a clean copy of the operating system to restore to factory. Well, what I learned this week was that if the computer is screwed up enough, then the recovery image will also be screwed up. And you can't reinstall Windows, even though you think you can. So that's really it. It's for any computer nerds out there.
Yeah.
Just go download a fresh copy of it from Microsoft. Don't try to create the recovery drive.
So that could have been a lot easier for you, is what you're saying?
Yeah, it took hours and hours, and it could have maybe just taken one hour.
A single hour of later.
Yeah.
Well, you did get it fixed.
I did get it fixed,
and it
finally
was a big relief, I remember.
It was.
I'm happy that you got it worked out.
It worked. I had to actually take apart the thing. I had to take two hard drives out of it.
You like that stuff, though.
I do like tinkering. It's true. Okay. Any final thoughts? Anything else?
No. Okay. I just, you know, take care of yourself, and
yeah,
we'll see you in 2 weeks.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Listeners, thanks for supporting 16 to 1.
We're trying to grow our audience, so please check us out at 16to1.com, all spelled out, and tell your friends about the show.
On our website, you can find links to follow us on social media, an archive of all our old episodes, and a contact form where you can get in touch.
Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next show.
Chicken wing, hot dog, bologna.